Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Hello and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss gastroenterology is Dr. Vinay Sood, a gastroenterologist with Albany Medical Center's Gastroenterology Group. He specializes in hepatology and pancreatic biliary diseases, a fancy term for issues affecting the pancreas, bile duct, and gallbladder. He sees patients with a wide range of GI problems, including GERD, liver disease, inflammatory bowel disease, and GI cancer. Dr. Sood earned his medical degree from New York College of Osteopathic Medicine, completed his internship and residency at the Albany Medical Center. Dr. Sood, welcome to the Medical Monday.
Good afternoon, Alan.
First time you've ever done this?
That's right.
Okay, so the number to call for all of you, and somebody's up there already, is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Well, one of the diseases that scares most of us, of course, is pancreatic cancer. We still don't really know how to diagnose that, do we, early on in order to catch it?
No, Alan, that's one of the biggest areas of research these days is how can we diagnose pancreatic cancer early before it becomes deadly. The incidence of pancreatic cancer over the last 50 years has not improved, nor has the survival rate. And at this point, only about 20% of people present with resectable disease. And even those who are resectable, only 20% are alive at 5 years.
So you said resectable. What does that mean?
It means it's operable, meaning it can be removed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So even those people who in whom it can be removed, 80% of those patients have disease recurrence within 5 years, and only 20% are alive at 5 years.
So what's the Whipple procedure?
That's the procedure where they resect the head of the pancreas. Most of these tumors, unfortunately, present late, and how they present is patients present with painless jaundice, and they have weight loss. Sometimes they'll have back pain, but by the time they get to the painless jaundice, the disease has advanced relatively far. And when they have painless jaundice, that's because the tumor in the head of the pancreas is now blocking or obstructing the bile duct and not allowing bile to flow. So bile builds up in the blood. Patients turn yellow or jaundiced. Oh. And unfortunately, at that point, it's often the cancer has advanced too far to be resectable, and all we can do is provide palliation with chemo and radiation.
So, Doc, what do you do that's unique?
So what I do is I am able to diagnose pancreatic cancers by performing a procedure called an endoscopic ultrasound. It's a procedure where a flexible scope, which has an ultrasound probe attached to it, is passed, down the throat into the stomach and first part of the intestine. It allows me to see through the stomach and intestine at the pancreas. I can then identify the tumor, pass a needle down the scope through the stomach and intestine and into the tumor to obtain a sample. And that helps in treatment. It helps direct chemo and radiation, or helps guide our surgeon in terms of what kind of surgery he's going to perform. In addition, patients who are jaundiced, I can alleviate or relieve their jaundice by placing a stent into the bile duct through a procedure called an ERCP.
Wow. So I'm going to ask you a question that always perplexes me. A lot of people say, hey, you don't want to get this stuff done here. You want to go down to New York or over to Boston.
Yeah.
How good are we compared to those institutions?
As far as I'm concerned, we're just as good. We have an excellent pancreatic biliary team here. I perform the advanced endoscopic procedures. We have excellent surgeons at Albany Med who can resect. They're trained at some of the top institutions across the country, such as Johns Hopkins, Mass General, and we can you know, resect these tumors, you know, provided they're not advanced. We have excellent oncologists who can provide, you know, chemo and radiation when indicated. There's just a lot of procedures we can do. Even myself, in addition to placing stents in the bile duct, you know, I can perform procedures. Sometimes these tumors invade the intestine and cause blockage. We can place stents through the GI tract to allow patients to eat better. I can provide nerve blocks for, you know, pancreatic cancer can be quite painful. Patients often can't even lay flat on their back. But one of the procedures I also do is celiac plexus neurolysis, where we sort of deaden the nerve by injecting alcohol and bupivacaine or a numbing agent, and really can provide a great deal of pain relief for these patients who are suffering.
We got some people on the line, but I want to ask you real quickly, how important is it that you have a first degree relative who had this kind of cancer?
That is important. There's no set guidelines, but more and more nowadays we're trying to screen patients with a family history.
How do you do that?
What we can do is this endoscopic ultrasound can allow us to get a close look at the pancreas. And, since, as I mentioned, by passing the scope into the GI tract or into the stomach, we're really up close with the pancreas. And we can get a real close look at the pancreas, the pancreatic duct. And in some cases, we can find a small tumor very early. And so more and more research is being dedicated to this. And we're studying genes which may be involved in the development of pancreatic cancer, and trying to screen those at high risk with either imaging such as an MRI or with this endoscopic ultrasound procedure.
Will MRI do it?
MRI is an excellent test as well. I think they're comparable, the endoscopic ultrasound and MRI. MRI has the advantage of being non-invasive, but endoscopic ultrasound at the time of the procedure, if we see something, we can get a sample. And, at the end of the day, tissue is the most important thing. So.
Sure. Okay, we'll go to Jim in Matamoras, Pennsylvania. All right. Jim, you're on.
Ed, do you see any cases related to infectious waterborne diseases such as Trichomonas fetus, Cryptosporidium, or Giardia?
Those are bacteria which more often cause colonic or diarrhea symptoms. So those are more often the culprits for infectious diarrhea. So often patients will present with refractory diarrhea, numerous watery bowel movements on a daily basis, and often we diagnose it either by doing stool studies or a colonoscopy and treating them appropriately with the with antibiotics. Really hasn't been found to be a relationship between pancreatic cancers and those bacteria.
Okay, Jim, thank you very much. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Every phone is going to be ringing at the end, folks. You want to get in. Do it now. Richard from Queensbury. All right, Richard, you're on. Okay, Richard, go ahead.
Okay, I read, three, four years back that there's some correlation between smoking and pancreatic cancer. Is this true?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there's definitely a strong correlation. Smoking, tobacco is a carcinogen and has been linked to, all kinds of cancers. Lung is the one which gets the most press, but there's a strong association between cigarette smoking and pancreatic cancer. So, in addition, alcohol is a risk factor. And so, anything we can do to eliminate these risk factors will promote overall well-being and health.
Like not smoking.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't smoke. Right. Richard, thank you for that very good question. Appreciate it very much. Okay.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, offering new urological treatments with urologist Dr. Paul Husson, NLH.org, for more information. Current Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. hosting a national symposium on life insurance compliance November 12th through the 14th at the Gideon Putnam Resort, Saratoga Springs, with registration now open, currentcompliance.com. Ellis Medicine, a comprehensive community healthcare network served by over 600 physicians, reinventing healthcare one patient at a time. 1-844-518-DOCS for appointments and referrals. Rock and Rye Tavern, New Paltz, a seasonal menu with locally sourced ingredients, classic cocktails, craft beers, and wine, served in a historic farmhouse with screened-in outdoor seating with views of the Shawangunks. rockandrye.com. And the Museum of Creative Process at the Wilburton Inn. Studying the creative process as a scientific conflict resolution mechanism, integrating psychology and morality into the moral science. museumofcreativeprocess.com.
And we are back. We're very fortunate to have him, Dr. Sood, and from Albany Med, and he is going to be, you know, talking to us about something we don't often hear about here, some of the diseases that he, as a GI doctor, looks at, and some very complicated ones. Let's go to Pete in Albany. All right, Pete, 1-800-348-2551. Go, Pete.
Hi. You know, my dad died of pancreatic cancer. He was a surgeon at all sorts of medical issues, but ultimately died of pancreatic cancer. And I'm an alcoholic, and I've suffered for about 15 years in and out. And I just wonder whether or not there's an indication, whether or not there's a propensity for that type of thing to move on.
So a correlation between pancreatic cancer and alcoholism?
Yeah. So, Pete, thanks for the call. You know, you actually have multiple risk factors at this point. You know, you have a family history with your father, a first-degree relative with pancreatic cancer. So that's one risk factor. And alcohol is another risk factor. I don't know if you smoke as well, but all these things, you know, can definitely contribute to pancreatic cancer. But in addition to that, you're at risk for all kinds of cancers. You know, you're at risk for liver failure and liver disease, you know, other cancers like, you know, colon cancer. So, you know, in my opinion, be in your best interest to do whatever it took and get help to stop drinking.
I've been sober for 15 years, and I have had a bout of ascites, so I'm in much better shape, but
yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I make sure you are plugged in with a gastroenterologist because, you know, patients with alcoholic liver disease are at risk in addition for esophageal varices, and that's where, you know, the liver gets is congested because of disease and blood backs up into other blood vessels such as the esophagus, and those blood vessels of the esophagus can rupture and can be life-threatening. So we can, you know, as gastroenterologists, we can do endoscopies, you know, do rubber band ligation of those esophageal varices if you have them, and, you know.
What does that mean, rubber band?
So what we do is patients with these esophageal varices, those are dilated blood vessels in esophagus. And that's, again, so the liver usually allows for blood flow through the liver, but when you have cirrhosis and liver disease, blood backs into other areas, and one of the areas is the esophagus, and those blood vessels could burst, and patients present to our hospitals with, you know, what we call hematemesis. They're vomiting profuse blood from these ruptured varices, and what we do in patients who have cirrhosis or liver disease is we will do an endoscopy prophylactically, and so we'll see if patients have varices and do this rubber band ligation or during an endoscopy, we can deploy these rubber bands to kind of cut off their blood supply.
Well,
and, you know, that really reduces a patient's risk of mortality.
My dad had extensive esophageal problems and was treated strong with Botox, actually.
Okay.
Okay, well, Pete, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks.
A lot of people present with liver cancer after another cancer is found. What's that about? They just metastasize to the liver?
That's right. A common place for GI tract cancers to spread is to the liver. And, you know, unfortunately, that is that represents stage four disease, and those patients are not candidates for surgery. So all we can do is provide palliation with chemo and radiation. So we can't cure them. We can just prevent or reduce the risk of spread further.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, we'll go to Raymond in Massachusetts. Okay, telephone number is 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. Go ahead, Raymond.
Hello. The doctor mentioned smoking as a contributing factor to pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
I had a friend in Oregon who got up in the morning, filled the toilet bowl with bright red blood, thought it was his ulcer, went to the ER, and within a very short time, was told that it was pancreatic cancer, and he lived 6 days. Mm. I did jump on a plane and fly out. He didn't smoke cigarettes, but he smoked large amounts of marijuana. I'm wondering if there's any evidence of that possibly being a contributing factor.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, marijuana use and particularly excess use has been linked to various cancers, so I wouldn't be surprised if that was a risk factor. But, you know, we have to realize the majority of cancers are sporadic, and, you know, so we can't say for sure if the marijuana, in fact, was the cause. You know, I imagine what happened in his case is sometimes these pancreatic cancers can grow to the point that they will invade the surrounding intestines and duodenum.
Yes.
You know, that tumor, when it invades into the intestine, can...
I must say that he had a card, a medical card for other issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that tumor may have eroded into the intestine and bled, which is why he had the lower GI bleeding you described.
He had chronic GI issues and essentially ulcer issues.
Right.
Years.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Raymond, I'm so sorry. We got a lot of people calling in now.
That's fine. My question has been answered.
All right, thank you, Raymond. Appreciate it very much.
Yep.
It's not a great idea to smoke marijuana if you don't have to.
No, that's right.
Anything else.
No,
okay.
I agree.
Thanks a lot. We'll go to Judy in Troy. Judy in Troy, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon.
Could you speak up a bit, Judy? I can hardly hear you.
Yes, thank you. I have just a quick question. The doctor was talking earlier about presentation of pancreatic cancer with late symptoms and so forth. It might be useful for the audience to hear from the doctor what symptoms, not just for pancreatic cancer, but in general, are a concern. Because lots of times people have to have something hit them over the head before they really say, this is not good. I have to check this out. When would he like to see people calling and getting in touch with their doctor about GI symptoms?
We got it. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good question, Judy. With GI issues, a lot of the things that patients present with and that are good or solid indications to see your provider, you know, abdominal pain, any significant abdominal pain out of the ordinary, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, rectal bleeding, loss of appetite. These are all reasons to see your doctor. Heartburn and reflux, which can't be controlled with over-the-counter medications, should definitely be evaluated. With pancreatic cancer, the symptoms that often patients present with are severe abdominal pain radiating to the back, associated with weight loss. Often patients will have jaundice. And for pancreatic cancer, new onset diabetes is often another presenting symptom of pancreatic cancer. And that's because the pancreas is an endocrine organ responsible for secreting insulin and glucagon. And so the pancreas assists in regulating your sugars. And when your sugars are out of control, that can be an early sign of pancreatic cancer.
On the other hand, almost everything you've said, Doc, can be anything else. I mean, you can have, three quarters of the American public have heartburn.
That's right.
And so, you have all of those things, and yeah.
That's right,
yeah.
Alan.
Yeah. Okay, listen, Judy, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. Phones are loaded. There's one free phone right now. Let's go to Kip in South Hadley. Kip in South Hadley, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I don't know much about pancreatic cancer, but I watched a TED talk recently in which a young man called Jack Andreka talked about a recent breakthrough in early diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. He was working with a professor in a lab at Johns Hopkins. And I wonder whether you know about this chap, Jack Andreka.
Yeah, I did hear about him, a high school student.
Yeah. He was using some kind of carbon nanotube technology to revolutionize the early diagnosis of this invasive problem.
Yeah, and I think, while the early reports were promising, I think it's diminished a little bit, and I think we were very hopeful at first that we may have developed some gene testing that would lead to the early diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, and I think it's a work in progress. But that's the goal, as opposed to colorectal cancer, where we have a screening test where we can, we can do a colonoscopy and remove precancerous polyps before it develops into cancer. We don't have such a screening test for pancreatic cancer. And as I mentioned, the morbidity and mortality from pancreatic cancer, the incidence of pancreatic cancer hasn't changed in the last 50 years. So, there's a lot of work to be done.
That's why I noticed it, because during this talk, he made everybody aware that pancreatic cancer is one of the worst ones for killing people
if
it's not diagnosed early, isn't it?
That's right. That's
Kip,
right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
You're welcome. The chef's name is Jack Andreka, A-N-D-R-A-K-A. Anybody who Googles that will find out about, what I thought to be the latest news about early diagnosis. Right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, and let's go to Bo in East Hampton. Bo, you're on.
Yes, hi. I have a question. In the case of someone who's had a couple of treatments for H. pylori and then on an upper endoscopy, a small patch of intestinal metaplasia is found in the stomach, what would the proper follow-up for something like that be?
Okay, Doc, before you do, you have to help us understand what these terms mean.
Okay. H. pylori or Helicobacter pylori is a bacteria which contributes to peptic ulcer disease. So it's a risk factor for ulcers.
And this is recently sort of discovered.
It's been in the news lately, but it's been for some time known to be a risk factor not only for peptic ulcer disease but also for gastric cancer. And so generally, if it is found, we treat it with antibiotics for 2 weeks, and then we will check a H. pylori stool antigen to confirm that the bacteria has been eradicated. And in eradicating this bacteria, we are reducing a patient's risk for gastric ulcers, reducing their risk for bleeding from the ulcers, and reducing their risk for gastric cancer.
Now, how do you know the difference between gastric cancer and a peptic ulcer?
Well, when we go down with the scope, you can tell an ulcer is a kind of a cratered out looking a specimen versus,
so you can spot it.
Yeah, versus a tumor is a protuberant, ulcerated, friable mass.
What is protuberant?
Meaning it's like a large bump or raised lesion versus an ulcer, which is carved out like a divot.
Right.
Yeah,
gotcha.
So,
gotcha. So Bo, now you had a question there in terms of.
Oh, yeah. Intestinal metaplasia. For the most part, intestinal metaplasia, we get more concerned about it when we see it in the esophagus.
What is it?
It's when the lining of the lining of the esophagus changes from normal. When you look under the microscope, the cells are more rounded.
So
usually,
what's the difference between dysplasia and metaplasia?
So dysplasia is when, that's when the esophageal cells are starting to turn into a precancerous type of condition. And that's what we discuss. We talk about with Barrett's esophagus.
Sure.
And so heartburn and acid reflux can lead to the change in the lining of your esophagus to this precancerous condition. And, interestingly, that's another advance in our field. Previously, when patients had high-grade dysplasia of the esophagus, we would send them off to our surgeons for an esophagectomy, which was a pretty morbid procedure. And nowadays, we have a technology which is called radiofrequency ablation, where we can use thermal therapy or heat to burn away these precancerous cells. And, it's really improved the patient's quality of life. And,
do that?
Yeah, we do that.
I do that.
Yes. And mm-hmm. So it's quite rewarding because years ago, patients would, go for esophagectomies, removal of the esophagus and, they're left in a tough shape. And nowadays we can do an outpatient procedure where we through the scope, we can pass these devices to burn the precancerous lining, and patients are doing well, many years out, not requiring such an invasive surgery.
Okay, so let me see if I get this straight. The first thing you get is Barrett's, the second thing you get is dysplasia, right?
That's correct.
And the third thing you get is cancer.
That's right. And so just like a colon polyp is a precancerous lesion, we want to get rid of that. Barrett's with dysplasia, particularly high-grade dysplasia, we want to get rid of that before it turns into cancer. And now we have this technology called radiofrequency ablation where we can, eliminate those precancerous cells.
So, Bo, you got everything you want?
So, my question still is, what would you do when it's found in the stomach rather than the esophagus?
Oh, intestinal metaplasia in the stomach, it's generally considered a benign condition. Some authorities will follow or some people will follow it up with a repeat endoscopy to ensure it doesn't there's no progression. But there's no strong evidence for that as compared to dysplasia in the esophagus.
So one last time. I'm so sorry, Doc. I'm not listening carefully enough. Metaplasia versus dysplasia. What's the difference?
So metaplasia means the stomach cells.
Yes.
They have some intestinal component to them. So. Which is not worrisome because it's not a precancerous condition.
I see.
Versus dysplasia is where the cell's now becoming discoherent and leading to potential precancer.
Hey, Bo, you've had your chance. Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate thank it. You.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll go to Lucia in Sogris. Lucia, you're on.
Hi.
Hello.
My question is about the effects, later on effects of radiation. I remember my family had anal cancer radiation about 3 years ago, and in the past year, she's had scarring or something, seems to be scarring in her small intestines, and then she's had CAT scans, MRI. She's had been to the emergency room a few times to have her stomach pumped because it's difficult to have food go down well. And what can you do about that? Where do you go? What do you ask?
Yeah, so, that's a difficult,
it's a difficult situation.
Yeah, radiation, it's meant to shrink tumors, but at the same time, it does have side effects, which include inflammation of the bowel. And that could lead, to scarring and narrowing of the bowel, which can lead to bowel obstruction, or it can lead to abnormal, twisting of the bowel around itself. It's a condition known as...
They were also saying that the tissue that replaces the original, within the scarring, that the paracelsus does not work the same way?
That's possible, but more often is, the inflammation leads to scarring, and uh-huh. Patients develop, either small bowel obstructions or an ileus where partially wrapped around itself, and that's probably why you're...
Obstruction.
Yeah, and that's why you're...
But they can't tell yet if it's in one place or more than one, and
right.
Is there some solution to this?
Yeah, unfortunately, that is a problem because, when you... it's such a diffuse process. If a surgeon is to go in, it's difficult to identify exactly which loop of bowel is causing these obstructions. And, unfortunately, there's no guarantees. We'll sometimes tell people there's, 30% chance they'll get better, 30% chance the same 30% chance worse when you're, you know, trying to deal with adhesions.
Right.
And so it's a very difficult situation. And, you know, at some point, if it becomes, you know, too frequent and interferes with a patient's quality of life, you know, you do have to go in surgically.
You just mentioned a word. You just mentioned a word which is interesting to me because we've seen a lot of it, and that's adhesions.
Yeah.
Could you explain to our audience what that is?
Yeah, so I think when patients have had numerous abdominal surgeries, you know, there's scar tissue which builds up and can lead to twisting of the bowel.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's dangerous, right? People die from it.
Yeah, you can have a life-threatening bowel obstruction as a result of adhesions. And so it's most commonly seen in patients who've had multiple abdominal surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a difficult situation because going back in surgically to, you know, try to take down these adhesions doesn't always work. And so, you know, it actually becomes, you know, quality of life. It's something that's happening rarely.
Right.
And sometimes people can just deal with it. But if it's occurring frequently, really interfering with the quality of life, you know, there's not too many options other than surgical intervention.
Lucia, we got to take a break. I thank you for your call.
Okay.
Appreciate
thank
it very
you.
Much.
Bye.
Okay, we'll take a break. We got three free phones, but Jeff and Larry are holding in there. We'll be right with them.
Support comes from Middletown Medical's Pediatric Express, walk-in urgent care for children in Chester with a pediatrician available weeknights until 9 p.m. MiddletownMedical.com. Hawthorne Valley Waldorf School, Harlemville, New York. Early childhood through grade 12. Accepting applications. Nurturing living connections. HawthorneValleySchool.org. Mass Live Arts at Bard College at Simon's Rock. Ending the festival with director Phil Soltanoff's One Video Man Show, An Evening with William Shatner Asterisk. July 24th through 26th at 8 p.m. MassLiveArts.org. Lucky Chocolates, Saugerties, New York. Organic and fair trade truffles and treats, seasonal chocolates, luckychocolates.com. And College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com.
And we're back. Dr. Sood, a lot of people have questions. We have a couple of open lines. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Jeff. Okay, Jeff, you're on.
Good afternoon, and thank you.
Sure.
I recall just a few weeks or maybe a month ago, we had an expert on who was asked very directly if there was any relationship or correlation between smoking marijuana and lung cancer. And her answer was no, that there is none. And so I was surprised to hear the doctor talking about marijuana as possibly being the cause of cancer. And I was just wondering if he could give interested readers any references that they could follow up on this subject of marijuana causing cancer.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I didn't say there's not a causal effect, but it has been linked to pancreatic cancer in that, you know, drug use, particularly cigarette smoking. So has been linked to pancreatic cancer, and marijuana use has been linked, but I don't think it's been identified as a causal factor in the development of pancreatic cancer. So obviously there's a lot of causes or links to pancreatic cancer, alcohol, cigarette smoking. And so, you know, anything we can do to reduce those risk factors, obviously family history is something we can't control, but if we do have a family history, we should get checked out. You know, so I can't give you any definite research articles at this point.
One could Google.
Yeah, you can definitely Google it, though.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's go to Larry in Albany. Larry in Albany, you're on.
Hi, this is Larry.
Yep.
Thank you for having me on. I'm curious about the correlation between gallbladder and the pancreas. I had a gallbladder infection many years ago, over 15 years ago, and had it removed, but it was severely infected.
Hold on a second, Larry. Larry, I want to ask you a question. Are you talking on some kind of device other than directly into a telephone? Because we can hardly hear you. Larry?
Is that better?
Try again. No, it's not better. Okay, go ahead, Larry. We'll get the question. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm calling about the correlation between gallbladder and the pancreas. I had a gallbladder removed that was severely infected many years ago, 15 years ago. And at the time, there were gallstones that caused backing up of the enzymes from the pancreas, and it caused severe pain, abdominal pain in my pancreas. So I'm wondering if damage could have been done to the pancreas or if there's a correlation between that kind of situation and further problems or cancer, even with in the future with the pancreas.
Thanks, Larry. That's a good question. You know, gallbladder disease and gallstones are independent of pancreatic cancer. Now, what it sounds like you might have had is an acute bout of pancreatitis due to gallstones. And sometimes what can happen is a gallstone can fall out of the gallbladder into the bile duct and lodge right where the gallbladder and right where the bile duct and pancreatic ducts empty. And that can cause an acute blockage of the pancreatic duct and cause pancreatitis.
Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah.
And so, you know, that same procedure I mentioned in ERCP, where we put a stent in the bile duct to relieve jaundice for patients with pancreatic cancer, we can also do that procedure for patients who come in with acute pain, sometimes who come in with that condition, gallstone pancreatitis, and we can remove the stone, endoscopically. In terms of the relationship with pancreatic cancer, one acute bout of pancreatitis due to gallstones should not raise your risk of pancreatic cancer. However, patients with longstanding alcohol abuse can develop chronic pancreatitis, and where the pancreas has longstanding damage from excess alcohol use, and chronic pancreatitis is in fact a risk factor for a pancreatic cancer.
Larry?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you.
All five phones, of course, are now ringing. We're going to try to go as quickly as we can, everybody. It's the final round. And so let's go to Janice in Albany. Okay, Janice, you're on.
Hello, this is Janice. I got a question. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I got a question about decreased gallbladder injection fraction of 11. And I think I'm going to end up having my gallbladder removed. My question is, how long should that arthroscopically take to recover physically? Because this is the last 6 months have been pretty painful and uncomfortable.
Does age have anything to do with it, Doc?
Yeah, I mean, the classic gallbladder patient is female, patient in their 40s. We describe the three F's: female, 40, fertile. They've had many. They've patients who've had many children or a few children. These are all risk factors for gallbladder disease. Obesity is another risk factor. But in any case, in terms of whether I guess you're planning on having your gallbladder out in the near future.
I see the surgeon tomorrow.
Okay.
And I just. I've had it. I'm ready.
Yeah.
Ready
so the classic gallbladder symptoms are pain in your right upper quadrant of your abdomen, usually occurring 30 minutes after eating and lasting a few hours. Oftentimes, it'll get to the point where patients are afraid to eat because of these symptoms.
What do you mean upper quadrant? Where's that?
Right. Right upper quadrant. You're right just below your right rib cage.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and patients are often afraid to eat, particularly afraid to eat fried fatty foods. Often, first line test is to do liver tests. Sometimes they'll be elevated in a patient with gallbladder disease. We'll also do an ultrasound, which will often show stones in the gallbladder. And that's enough of an indication to have the gallbladder removed. In rare cases, when patients don't have stones in the gallbladder and don't have elevated liver tests, we will do this HIDA scan, which she talked about, where we can identify how well the gallbladder is contracting. And if patients have symptoms of typical of gallbladder attacks and have a decreased ejection fraction, that's another reason to remove the gallbladder. And your recovery should be, sometimes it can either be same-day surgery or one day overnight in the hospital. And you should be, back on your feet feeling pretty good within a week's time.
Do you give them meds after that? I mean, what do they do? What do they do after the gallbladder is removed? Does it have a function or is it vestigial?
Most patients, the gallbladder serves as storage of bile. So after you eat a meal, the gallbladder will contract and secrete bile to help with digestion. When your gallbladder is gone, bile is secreted directly by the liver. Most patients do fine. Rare patients will have diarrhea, and we can sometimes we'll give patients a medication to bind the bile to help with diarrhea. But for the most part, patients do well.
Janice, we've got to move along. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so
much.
Okay,
let's go to Liv in Ballston.
Hello.
Hi, Liv. You're on.
Yes. My husband recently had a cardiac cath because he was experiencing pain, which he thought was in his heart, you know, particularly when he was walking uphill. And so they did the cath, and they found basically no real blockage, only 50%, and said it's not being caused by that. The cardiologist suggested that it might be a gastro issue. And I was wondering what kind of gastro issue would it be that would cause a pain that would feel like, you know, somebody, he says it's like somebody's giving him a noogie in the heart, you know, pushing noogie against his heart.
Yeah.
What kind of gastric problem could cause that kind of discomfort?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And there's a lot of overlap between cardiac and GI symptoms. So patients will often present with, substernal chest pressure, epigastric pain, it can be cardiac in nature or it can be GI in nature. The most important thing, the heart is first and foremost, so you have to make sure it's not a cardiac issue, which it sounds like your husband has done. Once the cardiologist feels comfortable saying it's not a heart issue, then we have to look at GI issues. And things that can mimic, cardiac symptoms include severe heartburn and reflux. That causes a similar burning in the chest.
No, I don't think he's got that. Okay. I have the GERD.
Yeah. So, ulcer disease, sometimes an ulcer can cause similar type of pain. And lastly, gallbladder stones or bile duct stones can cause similar symptoms. Gallbladder stones can be quite painful, and we've seen a lot of patients, particularly in the hospital, who come in with severe chest pain. They're first evaluated by our cardiologists, and only later during their workup is it found that, in fact, it was the gallbladder was the culprit.
Hey, Liv,
I was just wondering, would that be more prevalent, like if you're walking uphill? Because if he's walking on level surface, it doesn't bother him. When he's walking uphill.
Yeah, it would be less likely to be GI if it's affected by movement. You'd probably have to, sit down, talk with your doctor, and get a thorough history about, whether the pain is related to meals, movement, and things like that. So.
Okay, Liv, I'm so sorry. We're going to have to let you go, and we're going to try to get everybody in. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Liz in Albany. Liz, you're on.
Yes, I wanted to ask the doctor if he knows if biotin, I think it's milliequivalents, 5,000 milliequivalents taken daily for 4 to 5 months for thinning hair, was recommended by the dermatologist, can that irritate the GI tract?
Okay. I can't speak specifically to that, to biotin, but I can tell you that almost any medication you take, if you looked at its side effects, most every medication will have GI side effects. You'd probably need to go back and see if you were having these symptoms before you started the biotin or if it only began after the biotin. But again, most medications have the potential for GI side effects.
Would you feel an ache in both sides after you eat or drink if it were a GI issue?
That's something you'd have to talk to your doctor about. You'd have to have him do a thorough history and physical exam. Abdominal pain definitely should be evaluated by your primary physician, and if it's severe enough, by a gastroenterologist.
Okay, Liz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll go to Helena in West Hurley. Helena.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call, doctor. Will the effects of radiation on the bowel result in a colostomy bag?
That is the most extreme case.
Okay.
Most patients who've had radiation, they, again, like we talked about earlier, have scar tissue which develops. They can develop bowel obstructions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Usually it can be handled either with conservative treatment or surgery. In very rare cases, if it's severe and the patient has recurrent problems, you know, that would probably be the most extreme case where an ostomy would be required.
Yeah, okay. All righty, well, that answers my question. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Yep, bye.
And we'll go to Tom in Saratoga Springs, 1-800-348-2551. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Hey, Alan. Doctor, quick question. I'm 58, and I've noticed recently I've had some constipation, and I perform my ablutions daily, but things are kind of on a different schedule. And does this mean I should go and have either a colonoscopy or whatever, or
mm-hmm.
That was my, briefly, that's my question.
Yeah, so Tom, you know, first of all, everybody over 50 should have a colonoscopy because it's a test which has been shown to reduce the risk of colon cancer. So if you're 58 and you've never had one, you should have one just for screening purposes.
Right.
And that, again, is so that we can remove precancerous polyps and reduce your risk of colon cancer. If we do find what we can do, we can put a snare attached to cautery around these polyps, burn them off, and then send them off to the lab for analysis. We can use biopsy forceps to remove these polyps. If we find polyps, we'll repeat a colonoscopy in a 3 to 5 year time frame, depending on the number and size of the polyps. If no polyps are found, then we generally say people can go 10 years without a colonoscopy. If you have a family history of colon cancer, you should be checked sooner, usually 10 years prior to that relative. As far as your constipation, that is another warning sign. Diarrhea, change in bowel habits, whether it's diarrhea, constipation, rectal bleeding, should all be evaluated. It could be nothing, but it's more important, you know, we prefer to err on the side of caution.
Right.
And you should definitely have a colonoscopy, not only, one, because of your age, and two, because of the symptoms of constipation.
Okay,
right.
Tom, got to go.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay, we'll go to David in Schenectady. David, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. I had my gallbladder removed about 2.5 years ago, and I've had some diarrhea ever since. I'm now told I have post-cholecystectomy syndrome.
Mm.
And take Imodium. I'm just wondering if there's a better alternative. And it just affects the quality of life, you know, little anxiety here.
Okay.
And there.
Yeah, Dave, that's a good question. And I think, people who have had their gallbladder removed as a result can have an excess bile in the intestinal tract, and that can lead to bile acid-induced diarrhea. And there are some meds we can give patients to bind that bile. There's a medicine called cholestyramine. So why don't you ask your doctor about cholestyramine? That's a medication which will bind the bile, and I've had good success with it in patients who've had their gallbladder removed. So I think, you have more options than just the Imodium.
Okay, one other quick question. A friend of mine has the same problem. He takes colo...
Yeah, that I think that's the same one.
Welchol.
Yeah, so that's the same medication. That's just the brand name.
Yeah.
And... I would definitely give it a try.
Give it a try?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a prescription, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, David. Appreciate it. Okay.
Thanks so much. Yep.
Well, we did it. We're out of time, and we have no one to apologize to because we got them all. Okay, I want to thank Dr. Vinay Sood for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Toprasin, natural creams designed to address the epidemic of addiction to pain medicine by providing pain relief for the 21st century, Toprasin.com. And thanks to our engineer, the wonderful Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell, our wonderful friend who answers the phones. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall, and I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/VoxPop. Make sure you take WAMC with you. Download our new mobile app for streaming audio, headlines, podcasts, and more. I use it all the time, by the way. It's fantastic. You just go to iTunes or Google Play App Store. You search for WAMC. It takes a few seconds. You install it. It's a terrific thing. You'll never be without it wherever you are in the world. On tomorrow's program, an open forum. Stay tuned now for a news update.